Welcome back to Balagan. November 29, 1947 was the day that the United Nations accepted the partition plan for Palestine, also known as UN Resolution 181. The resolution recommended the creation of independent Arab and Jewish states with a special international area in the city of Jerusalem. The partition plan was accepted by the General Assembly on that day, on November 29, 1947. How can it be that an international resolution that was accepted by the world now seems so unreal in a way, when you have all of the BDS and pro-Hamas supporters who are rallying in the streets saying, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, while on the other hand, in Israel, we have some people that also want to have the same thing, from the river to the sea, the Jewish state will be free. And I'm talking about the settlers, of course, the Messianic settlers, that both of these sides are not actually seeking for peace, sadly speaking. They just seek to eliminate the other side. In order to speak about that and other issues that are bothering us these days, I was happy to speak once again to my friend Ido Dembin, who is the executive director of Molad, the Center for the Renewal of Israeli Democracy. Let's hear what he has to say. I would like to add one more thing. If you find this podcast valuable, informative, and enlightening, please share it with others. This is a private initiative. I'm not making any money out of it. I'm just trying to bring some more context about what's happening in Israel, what Israelis think, and how our system works. So thank you very much for listening, and thank you very much for your ongoing support.
Ido, welcome back to Balagan.
Thank you. It's great to be here again.
And it's actually great to record with you in person, because we're recording from Jerusalem, from your offices. So thank you for hosting me.
It's always a pleasure, and it gives me an excuse to get people up to Jerusalem.
It's easy to get me to Jerusalem, especially to such a beautiful house like that, because I literally am willing to live here.
I think I told the owner that I was wondering, like, can I rent it as an office, but also as an apartment? I was like, I'm not sure the tax authorities are okay with that, but you can try.
Well, I'll take a note on that for next time. So, Ido, I want to ask you, we are at war, and let's start with, where were you on October 7th? How did you hear about what was happening in the south?
You know, it feels like Israelis, every country has its, where were you when, right? Where were you when JFK was assassinated? When Rabin was shot? And I think this really does, like, this question kind of is going to be asked for a while moving forward. People are going to remember specifically where they were on October 7th in Israel. It just goes to show you just how impactful what happened is going to be, I think, moving forward, if it isn't already. But I was actually in Washington, D.C. I was coming off the back of a week-long seminar, meeting with folks in civil society, in government, and officials in the administration, as part of a delegation from Israel and the U.S., so leading, always funny to say that about yourself, but leading liberal leaders. We're talking about the judicial overhaul in Israel and about normalization with the Saudis. And this was all the way into October 6th. And I think it was around 1 a.m. Washington time, so around 8 a.m. Israel time on October 7th. That I was just doom scrolling Israeli media, and all of a sudden I see everything that's happening. I'm starting to get messages from, like, I'm seeing, like, in the family chat on WhatsApp, is everyone in shelters? And I'm like, what the hell is happening? And needless to say, I ended up not sleeping too much that night. By the time morning came, my flight back to Israel, which was supposed to head out that day, was canceled. And my wife and I spent another week in Washington and in New York trying to find a way to help from there and to get ourselves back to Israel. It took us a week, but we ended up on one of the return flights with Alan.
And I assume that many of your friends are now in the front. And
I've got a decent group of friends in the front. I actually might be going myself fairly soon. I hope not, but you know, I got a call. So it depends on what they decide at this point. And yeah, at this point, I'm slightly on the more on the older side of the reserves. Kind of weird to say, but I'm 36 going on 37. So most of my friends are at this point married with kids. Not everyone goes.
Yeah.
Some just can't, others won't. Most go, especially like if they're called, most go. My Facebook and my Twitter feed have basically become this mix of photos of folks in uniform and kind of, it's upsetting to say, but obituaries of people who knew people who died.
Yeah. Yeah, same here. I have a lot of friends actually that volunteer. I'm a bit older than you.
Mm. I told you before we started, you don't seem older than me, but.
Well, thank you for the compliment. But you're leading, I would say, policies think tank
mm-hmm.
here in Israel. And from your perspective,
mm-hmm.
how did we get to October 7th?
How much time do you have?
I have the time. It's up to you.
I think the thing to remember and to know and even to understand about where we are at the moment is this wasn't a last-minute thing. It wasn't, sure, there was the tactical aspects, right, of Hamas utilizing a particular moment and the way the IDF was prepared outside of Gaza, etc. But in terms of how we got here, the strategy failures, the collapse of paradigms, of Israeli, you know, misconceptions about Israeli security, diplomacy, all of this, this has been a process that started at least as far back as 2009 and probably even before that. So it's important to understand that, you know, first in terms of how it all came to be, that this isn't a one-time thing. This is part of a slow decline in the way that Israel operates that I think has a lot to do, if not everything to do with the government or the governments by a particular Benjamin Netanyahu. He's the self-described protector of Israel, Mr. Security, Mr. Diplomacy, Senior Economy, right? He knows all there is to know about everything. I think at any given point in his career, you can find him as either one of the three. They called it the Sar Al or the super minister.
Yeah, that's how he portrayed himself when he put, I think, Yuval Steinitz as a minister of finance.
Exactly.
But under him.
Exactly, which is ridiculous. And then he's the Mr. Security, and then he's the Mr. Diplomacy, who has a Ministry of Foreign Affairs, but that ministry is underfunded, is divided into like four different ministries, four different people, you know, people who are listening to this might see like a statement by the Israeli Ministry of Intelligence.
Yeah.
And they think, oh my God, the Ministry of Intelligence, that sounds big. Pardon my French, but it's bullshit. It's a non-relevant ministry made up to give a nice cushion to someone Netanyahu wanted to pamper. Doesn't mean anything, doesn't do anything of substance, but it sounds like it's a big deal.
And today it creates a lot of damage, I will say, because for non-Israelis who are unfamiliar with Israeli politics, when they hear that a cabinet member was saying something or calling for transferring the Gazans to a
humanitarian?
Humanitarian transfer or something like that.
Ridiculous.
And that's, by the way, the Minister of Intelligence, Gila Gamliel. I'm not sure if she knew that that's the ministry she's in charge of. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, it's in America, if we look at it, it's, you're talking about governance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we cannot ignore the fact that the current government was the one who's saying, we want to do the judicial overhaul or the judicial reform in order to improve governance because the Supreme Court is a problem.
Yeah.
So it seems now, I think that it seems clearer than ever that it wasn't the Supreme Court who was doing some governance challenges. What do you think about it?
I mean, you know, ever since this war started, everyone but the government has been functioning. you've seen civil society organizations step into the role of everything from logistics to mental health,
yeah,
to anything in between, honestly. If it's helping farmers in the South find volunteers to help them in the harvest, or if it's finding psychologists, or if it's getting people coming in from wherever, A, to find their way back to Israel, at least in the beginning parts of the war, yeah, right? When people were flocking back to the war. And even when I was coming back, I mentioned that I was a bit late. So by the time that I made my way back to Israel, Brothers and Sisters in Arms, which again is a civil society organization established to combat the government and its overhaul that you mentioned. At that point, this organization was already focused on getting military supplies. And when I got to the airport, to the one El Al flight that was available, myself and my wife, we met friends from the organization there who gave us 6 or 7 bags full of equipment, batteries and cameras and flashlights and whatever, not weapons, but you know, everything around it that a soldier might need. And kind of like, take this with you in your baggage because the government isn't supplying it in Israel. So I had to bring it with me from New York, and that happened faster. So, you know, just to kind of shine a light on the governance claim. And you already see like ministers in the government using this moment to try and continue their incitement against the courts and against everyone else. Like the Minister of the Judiciary, Yair Levin, the person behind the overhaul, actually went ahead and said something about how the court has stopped the IDF from operating in Gaza, which is just a blatant lie. But he's saying it because he needs to keep his overhaul under, you know, on the back burner in case he still manages to do it and to carry on with it once the war is over.
Yeah.
I don't think he'll manage, but the fact that they're still thinking about it and focusing on it, it's hard to come to terms with.
Yeah, we are actually today, while we are recording, the Knesset is actually passing the budget.
Yeah.
And when we are talking about budget, a lot of the budget in Israel goes by what you call the coalition accords, the coalition agreements. Mm-hmm. And the current government or the current coalition is unwilling to cut all of the funding that is supposed to go to two main sectors.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox. Second one is the settlers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, for example, when we're talking about governance, is there a possibility that they're going to go into a clash with the Supreme Court now, for example, if somebody's going to appeal against those coalition agreements because they will say, we need the money because of the war. And it needs to go to prioritize things differently.
That's an interesting question. I guess being a lawyer myself, I tend to not like the option of appealing to the courts. Not because the court isn't efficient or because I don't trust the court. That's not it. I think we should try to the extent that we can to abstain from leaving major decisions on policy to the court. I also think it, at least to some extent, it kind of gives away how inefficient our camp is politically. And I think this is a moment where our camp can be efficient politically. There are members of our camp, not only in the government, but whose presence in the government as members of the coalition, I'm talking about Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot and other such generals who found their way into government. If they were to leave the government because of this, that would be one hell of a statement. And one that could actually, I think, lead to the collapse of the government, at least in the medium term, because I think a lot of its legitimacy would crumble.
Right.
And considering the fact that I don't trust Netanyahu to manage and run the war, not now, not against Hezbollah, if we find ourselves in one, I don't think that's such a bad idea. But I think there is a tendency in our camp to kind of not make difficult decisions because we are afraid of what they might say or how they might paint it. We know that they're much more efficient than we are in terms of propaganda and media use. And I think people like Gantz are, I don't know, right? But I would imagine that he's under immense pressure to not do anything because of what it might look like or what he might be depicted as. And I think it's a mistake. I think he's probably the strongest political actor in Israel right now, and this is a good time to show his strength.
Yeah, if we're talking about guns, he always says that he's willing to go under the stretcher.
Yeah.
And he's proving it time after time. The only thing that he's missing is that somebody else is actually loading the stretcher. And I don't know why it happens to him.
I mean, he's going under the proverbial sketch, but he's also, who's the person on it?
Yeah.
And it's often the Haredis and the ultra-Orthodox and the settlers and whoever. It's not only that they're not helping, they're making it more difficult. And it's not only that they're adding equipment, as you say, they're jumping on it and he gets to carry them. And I think that's what Netanyahu also wants, is to have someone to pin the blame on in the event that something happens.
Well, I'm quite sure that that's what he was doing when he asked them to join.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, for talking politically wise, if I would be the opposition in Israel, first thing I would have, you know, Gantz and Lapid running to, not running together, but setting the same terms to go with Netanyahu. They had the opportunity to put a leverage at that time, telling him three simple things. This is my point of view. First one, we're going to go into a coalition with you, but we are dismantling the government after the war, when the war ends, and we'll go to an election. Second thing, get the Haredim and the Smotrichim and Benfim, as we like to call them, the messianic right wing, from your coalition. And let's eliminate all of the irrelevant offices, the ones you were talking about. You're mentioning the Ministry of Intelligence. More than half of these offices are fake offices that were, you know.
I mean, the Yair Lapid put out a statement today. He also, by the way, at the time, he proposed what you're saying, and Gantz went ahead without him. But Lapid put out a statement today saying there isn't actually a need for half of these offices. And he's right. You know, there is a minister, like, to American ears, this might sound completely nuts, but like, there is a minister for tradition. There's a minister for legacy, as it's called.
Yeah.
Like Jewish legacy.
Two different offices.
Yes.
Tradition is one, legacy is different.
There is the Ministry of Religion, which some people actually think is needed when you don't have a separation of church and state, it might be needed. There's a ministry for national tasks. That's an actual ministry.
Yeah.
Run by one of the messianic ones, by Ohit Stuk from the
Huletin Ched one.
And, you know, what do these ministries do except for wasting money? There's a minister, there's even a minister for the diaspora who hates the diaspora.
Yeah.
Like Amichai Shikli, the minister for the diaspora, literally despises any non-Israeli Jews. It's kind of like putting a pacifist in, you know, the Ministry of Defense.
Yeah.
It makes absolutely no sense. But these ministries exist again as political cushions and gifts, and I won't say almost bribe to the folks who support Netanyahu.
It is. And I think that the current government may be the biggest one.
Yeah.
But having those political acts and, you know, bribing the small parties is not something that was created by Netanyahu. No. I think that he just mastered it. And
you're exactly right.
You know, speaking on the next day, you know, the day after the war, do you think that one of the changes will be a real reform in the separation of powers and founding a constitution that will set the rules of the game and how many, you know, members the cabinet will have and what's going to be the relations with the Knesset that is actually being controlled by the government these days?
I think that's a really good question. Put it this way, okay? And you asked me first, how did we get here, right? And I said, it's not the result of something that happened just now. It's a longer process. Let me elaborate on that for a bit, if you don't mind. I would have blabbered, but hear me out. There are a number of misconceptions and paradigms that collapsed on October 7th. Some of them include the idea that you can manage the conflict and not solve it. Some of them are the fact that Israel chose to empower and strengthen Hamas and weaken the PA and Abu Mazen.
The Palestinian Authority.
Yes, thank you. Some of them include the Israel's choosing, again, to align itself with Russia or with Hungary or Poland or whichever illiberal semi-autocracy and kind of distance itself from the US. We saw how well that helped and that happened. And you know, God bless for Joe Biden for ignoring Netanyahu's shenanigans and still standing next to Israel in this, because it was not, you know, it wasn't as clear when the war started that the Americans are going to ignore everything that Netanyahu has done against the Democratic Party and just stand beside Israel. There's the idea that you can make peace in the Middle East without the Palestinians, right? You can make peace with Morocco and with the Bahrain and whatever, and you can ignore your next door neighbor, or they will just like at some point give up.
Yeah.
And there are many other ideas. And one of those other ideas is this idea that A, you can continue to incite against most institutions, against the court, academia, the press, and against half the people, right? Everyone who's not with me is probably against me. And because I represent the people, then they're against the people and against the nation. And there's this idea that all of these things can be amended if we just give the government ultimate power. I think both of these ideas collapsed completely. And you know, even before the war, there wasn't a great deal of support for the overhaul, for instance. Netanyahu was already back, sliding in the polls and losing. His coalition was down from 64 to around 55. Now it's down to around 45, even less.
Even less, yeah.
And I think it's A, because of just how bad everything has been, but also because people are realizing the risks and the dangers of giving these folks, who I would not trust in managing a shoe store, no disrespect to shoe store managers, such power. Whether or not the next people in power are going to try and change it, you know, to the extent that you described, is, I think, an open question that depends very much on the political constellation at the time. Like, we don't yet know if Benny Gantz is actually going to get 41 seats, or is there going to be like a center-right party with Naftali Bennett who's going to take like 15 of those projected seats? And if so, will they be able to form a center-ish coalition? And even if they do, who's going to be a member?
Who's going to be a member of this coalition?
And that, you know, that impacts significantly. And to some extent, I suppose we'll see some protests as well. Like, the right wing might feel emboldened by the left wing protest. And if Israel tries to, let's say, create a constitution that separates church and state, the Haredis are going to, we're going to hear from them. They're not going to just let it slide because of the war. So is there a need? Yes. Is there the political moment? Yes. Is there the strength and the willingness and the courage? I don't know yet. And I'm not willing to bet that there is.
Yeah, that's the biggest concern.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, eventually you're mentioning what was happening and you're talking about Netanyahu. Netanyahu always mastered, I would say, the divide and conquer approach. It Absolutely. Was always me and us and them. It was always, it's not me that they're afterward, you know, they're after you as us.
The listeners can't see me, but I'm nodding ferociously. Like, yes.
The main, you know, what we always saw is that eventually, until the current coalition, that I'm not sure that he actually wanted it to be. I think that it was his plan B, yeah. I would say. That's why he legitimized Itamar Ben-Gvir, who is Meir Kahana's successor. Mm-hmm. Meir Kahana was, I would say, a Jewish right. I don't find a better way to describe him, but he was a Jewish supremacist.
Yeah, I don't think I actually think he would be okay with that definition himself.
Yeah.
If you called it to his face, he would be like, yeah, that's accurate.
That even the Likud party in the 80s banned from being a member of the Knesset. But Netanyahu, for years, mastered in taking, I would say, a center-left, you know, fig leaf, or as we say in progressive whitewashing, or to legitimize him with the world. And then he would always put the blame on them for why things don't, wasn't working, because my hands won't die.
Right.
And now that he has a great wing, you know, a wonderful right-wing government, they haven't annexed the West Bank like they promised they will do. What they decided to start with was to eliminate, you know, the checks and balances with the Supreme Court. I think that in the long run, we're seeing what's happening in the world today. I think what they did the most is actually delegitimize Israel in the world. And from that, I want to take you to another point, because in 2 days, we're recording on November 27th. On what we call in Hebrew, Kaftet Benovember, November 29th, 47, the United Nations voted for the partition plan. Partition plan literally spoke about splitting the land of Eretz Israel, Palestine, between the Jews and the Arabs, giving the Arabs two different areas that, by the way, I will say never made any sense to me. How can you create a country that is divided, you know, into two different areas that have no connection with it? But we said yes, the Arabs said no. And for many years, Israel actually supported the two-state solution. While if we're looking at the BDS movement and, you know, Hamas, they don't believe in partition plan. They believe in one state from the river to the sea. Palestine will be free. Well, on the other hand, if we're talking about our, you know, people like Ben Gvir and Smotrich, they are literally also supporting a one-state solution. What happened to this two-state solution? Do you think that it's gone? Do you think that we can ever do it? I mean, honestly, you know, we discussed it before. There are a couple of alternatives. They're all bad, but there is the worst and there is the least worst.
It's like what Churchill said about democracy, right? It's the least bad of all. Look, first of all, to your first point, I think that it's crucial to understand that beyond all of the Hasbara talking points about how Israel accepted the partition plan and advocated for it, even whereas the Arabs did not, I think, at least in part, that serves kind of the way that both sides' historical narratives have been created. The Israeli one and the Zionist one is very much that of, we had nowhere to go, and this land had no one to be in it, which is wrong, but that's what we've been taught.
David Ben-Gurion said it beautifully in Hebrew.
Yeah, people without a land to a land without a people. The problem with that is that there were 1.2 million Muslims living in the land of Israel in 1948, and 600,000 Jews, and even that is after many waves of Aliyah from Europe, etc. But I don't want to go too much into that history. I do want to say, though, that early Zionists were more than happy to share the land, in part because they thought this was our only option to have a land. Over time, and especially in 1967, when Israel conquered the West Bank and Sinai, Gaza, and the Golan Heights, I think a lot of people had I don't want to say a change of heart or a change of faith, because it's not like all Israelis became religious, but all of a sudden, the fact of Israel became quite stable. The notion that Israel is on the verge of non-existence was kind of removed. So now that Israel is going to be here, the question becomes, like, what exactly are its borders going to be? And if we can get the borders of the judicial promised land, the biblical promised land, we might as well. But at the same time, I think a lot of people, Israel as a state, was never willing to make that step to annex the West Bank, and for good reason, because there was always another people living there. And the official policy of Israel was always, even in the Declaration of Independence, Israel relies on the UN decision, it mentions it, and it calls for peace with our Arab neighbors. That's the exact words, right? We call for peace. Even in during this war, we call on our neighbors, etc. And sometime between 1995, when Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated, and 2023, mostly right-wing years, mostly Netanyahu years. He's been in power for 14 of the last 18 years and another three before those.
Yeah.
So the longest-serving ever prime minister of Israel. And Arik Sharon was the prime minister for a while, who disengaged from Gaza, but was as far right as any other prime minister, with only Ehud Barak and to some extent Ehud Olmert representing the center-left in power during those times. Israel swayed to the right. And at the same time, where Israel's political discussion became so swayed that the so-called Obertone window opened to the right wing and kind of allowed folks like Ben-Gvir and others to become legitimate actors, the Palestinians on their end are looking at us. They're saying, okay, there is no progress to two states. The last negotiation was in 2008, the Annapolis Convention, I think.
Yeah, between Olmert and Mahmoud Abbas.
Yeah, and after that, essentially nothing.
Even it depends how you look at it. In theory, in 2010, Netanyahu made his famous Bar-Ilan speech.
Yeah.
I remember some of our friends, were actually fascinated. Oh, Netanyahu is going to go for it.
I remember in 2009 when Obama pressured Netanyahu to freeze construction in the settlements. I was an officer in the IDF at that time. I was serving in settlements, and I can promise you they were not frozen. But anyway, I digress a bit. But my point is that we swayed from the two states, but we haven't necessarily swayed towards the one state. What had happened was, you know, you mentioned the fringes, the Ben-Gvirs on one hand, and it pains me to make that comparison, but the progressive left calling from the river to the sea and stuff like that. And I think the kind of mainstream, what had happened was the mainstream lost its faith in the idea of two states. So it's not that the mainstream Israeli decided that one state would be better insofar as they decided the two states cannot happen anymore. For various reasons, we can get into that. But and what's happening now is because of everything that's happened since October 7th, people are slowly starting to get disillusioned with their attempts to ignore it. In other words, ideas like managing the conflict, right? We can mow the lawn in Gaza every few years, and we'll continue weakening the Abbas, and everything will be okay. You know, we don't need the Palestinians. They're in the powerful words of Naftali Bennett, they're a thorn in our butts and nothing more. I think that's starting to fade. The idea that we should just shrink the conflict is also fading. It was always an alternative to managing it anyway. And we're left with a choice between going back to negotiations, which most people, even today, are not willing to even consider, or the worst alternative, which is all-out war. And what I think is going to happen is that right now the two states is the lowest it's maybe ever been in the short term, but in the medium term, it's going to become very clear that it's the only viable option. It's not the best option. It's just the only option. How long exactly that would take? And
if we want to maintain Israel as a nation state for the Jewish people.
I think more than that, I think even if we are reluctant to make a decision on that, people are going to have to come to terms with the fact that we're surrounded by, in part at least, hostile enemies and neighbors who don't like us. But neither did the Egyptians in 1973.
They still don't, by
the way. But, at least as a people. Right, but
right.
The peace accord has been surviving for decades.
Right.
The Jordanians don't love us.
Right.
But we have a peace accord with them. Hell, even the Syrians don't like us, but there is some sort of ceasefire that was okay and was very quiet until the Syrian civil war, where everything started to collapse there. But between 1973 and 2011, that was the quietest front of Israel's borders.
Yeah, the Syrian border, by the way, is literally the quietest, even after the civil war going on in Syria.
No one talks about what if the Golan is invaded, right? We're talking about what if Hezbollah invades the north, like Metula or Kiryat Shmona or whatever. No one's talking about what happens if Maom Golan is captured, right? And I guess the point in all of that is Israel and Israelis need to learn to accept that we cannot win all of this by the sheer force of the IDF. There are only so many people we can recruit, and only so much weapons you can use, and only so much money you've got, and only so much support that the world is willing to lend to you. And an all-out war on four or five fronts, bombing in Sana'a against the Houthis in Yemen in the morning, and then bombing Beirut in the evening, and in between trying to occupy Damascus, is not a viable solution. And so Israelis are going to have to come to terms with the fact that the only solution that can make our life here anything but hell is a diplomatic. It's a tough sell at the moment, but I'm going to try. So
yeah, I think that, you know, your main point here that you're talking about the diplomatic solution, that's a missing component when we hear the policymakers talking about this war's goal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that I ever heard, you know, for example, Netanyahu, who has a really polished English. no, seriously.
Yeah,
he really knows. I love his, I mean, I can't say I love his English, but I'm jealous.
He's a very well-spoken, very eloquent speaker.
So, but I never heard him saying, you know, I'm demanding that the Red Cross will provide us with data, what's happening with the hostages. To say honestly, I'm concerned that most of them are dead. I don't know if it's real. I hope that I'm wrong, but I don't know. And it doesn't make any sense to me, like the way that they're handling the, you know, the hostages negotiation, that it goes like a salami process. Every day you have another wave. It only helps the moment the Hamas, because we don't even know who's going to be released.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that
Hamas still controls or still has that level of control is worrying, especially to Israelis who are not seeing what most of the world is seeing in the media.
Right.
And, you know, as Israelis, we're under the impression that the IDF is winning.
Right.
But then Hamas has so much power still that you begin to question, like, it's been almost 2 months of this war. Hamas is still seemingly firmly in power.
Yeah, and look, sadly speaking, you know, yesterday in Tul Karem, I don't know if you got to see the photos, two young men were executed on the main street. They were lynched and then hung because the Hamas decided they were traitors who were talking to the Shin Bet. We don't know if it's true or not, but Hamas has the power. And I didn't hear, you know, talking about Netanyahu and the Red Cross, I didn't hear at any point that we are actually setting a goal for this war. The only thing we're saying, we're going to eliminate Hamas and we're going to bring the hostages back.
Yeah.
And I don't think that it can work. You can either bring down Hamas at the cost of also literally eliminating our hostages. And even then, I doubt if we can eliminate the concept of Hamas, because it's hard to kill an idea. You can kill the people, but, you know, while on the other hand, I don't see that they're giving the army, the IDF, some sort of an exit point.
I don't think that they have one, if I'm being completely honest. And so far, what I've been hearing from Netanyahu, and you're exactly right that he hasn't been using his polished English for promoting the day after. It's not quite clear, truly, what the goal of this war is. And this is something that needs to be kind of driven home. Most Israelis consider defeating Hamas as a goal in and of itself. By the way, not the biggest goal. According to a poll from, like, I think yesterday,
Bringing
the hostages is the number one priority for Israelis, which I think is saying something. I'm not sure if this was the sentiment a month ago. But I think the longer this goes, people are becoming a bit weary of an elongated war. A lot of people are in reserves and soldiers are dying. And slowly but surely, Israelis are coming to terms with the idea that war sucks and that we maybe forgot of it, but war comes with a great price and the total war comes with a total price. Total war in Hamas is quite an ordeal, even if Israel can do it. You raise some very good questions. Like they said before the war, Hamas has 40,000 terrorists.
Give and take, yeah.
So give and take, Israel killed about 5,000, according to the highest estimates I've heard.
Right.
That leaves you with at least anywhere between 25 and 35. Let's say half of them scatter because they're terrified. Fine. That still leaves you with plenty of Hamas dicks.
Right.
And does Israel want to go to war in the south of the Gaza Strip as well? Do we actually aim for total occupation of the Gaza Strip, as Netanyahu has maintained? And if so, is the world going to be okay with it? We've seen, and this is, I think, where the splinters are going to come up between Israel and Biden,
right,
who so far has been very supportive. When and if Netanyahu refuses the parameters that Blinken set forth, which include, you know, maintaining the integrity of Gaza as a territorial unit, not maintaining Israeli occupation for a prolonged period of time, bringing back some form of Palestinian self-rule that will be the same government in both the West Bank and Gaza. These are all things that Netanyahu is less than eager to do.
Right.
But he hasn't presented an alternative. He hasn't said like, okay, no, so what we're going to do is this instead. And if he doesn't do it, there is going to be a cost. You know, the American money and ammunition and resources and Biden losing support in the U.S., eventually that's going to take its toll. I don't think Biden is going to stop supporting Israel because I think he's genuinely a Zionist, which is astonishing. But yeah, Israelis need to understand that this comes with a price and we need to make up our minds. And we have not been able to do that. And I don't think there's been enough discussion either. Like, even if most Israelis support, and I do, I support bringing down Hamas, you know, assuming we can. My concept of the day after and Netanyahu's concept are wildly different in that I have an idea and he doesn't. So,
when I think that he has an idea.
I mean, if he has, he hasn't shared it with us, you know, us Israelis. I mean,
yeah,
we don't know what he wants. He's just saying the idea of who controls Gaza. He's not saying anything about who controls the administrative aspect. Who collects taxes? Who provides services? Who reconstructs all the God knows how many structures in Gaza has collapsed since the war started? Who does all of that? Is Israeli taxpayer money going
to rebuild Gaza?
Which, by the way, I'm fine with, but that needs to be said.
Right.
To Israelis.
If the coalition votes on it, then it's fine. But, you know,
to be clear, I'm fine with it to the extent that I think Israel has a responsibility for the day after in Gaza. Doesn't mean I think Israel needs to reoccupy Gaza. I think any solution in the longer term will necessitate a local version of the Marshall Plan. And that will also include an Israeli investment.
I agree. And I think, by the way, it should be, if I was a decision maker, which I'm not, I would actually make it an Arab effort, you know, utilizing the United Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, which I'm not a huge fan of Qatar because they're playing on both ends of the field. But having the Arab world leading the effort to rebuild Gaza and to establish actually, I would say, a new kind of governance over there. Because eventually Israel cannot live, let's be honest with that, with another threat like that. And, you know, if we're talking about the north, there need to be a solution found with Hezbollah as well. And I doubt if the West can help us with that. I doubt if we can provide it on our own. I think that for political terms, Netanyahu likes to make everything as, once again, us and them, but Israel against the world.
I wonder if there is a war against Hezbollah, will the progressive left be, I'm sorry for mocking them, but it needs to be marked. If they're going to chant like, Lebanon shall be free from Beirut to the valley, you know, like, I genuinely wonder. But if we're being honest, though, I think you're right in that I don't know many countries that are okay with having two terrorist organizations governing their neighbors, right? One in Gaza, one in Lebanon. Imagine if Mexico was run by Al-Qaeda. I don't think the U.S. government would be
then okay shooting at the U.S.
Yeah, and shooting at San Antonio or whatever, right? Like, it's crazy. And I think Israeli Hasbara has been terrible at explaining that, by the way. But yeah, that's definitely something that Israel is going to have to tend to at some point. And by the way, the fact that it just dawned on me as you were saying it, I think part of the reason why the Netanyahu government is not saying what you said, is not saying, let's bring in the Saudis and the Egyptians and the Emirates, essentially is because it goes against everything that Netanyahu wanted. I mentioned it earlier, that Netanyahu wanted to make peace without the Palestinians.
Right.
And all of a sudden, it's peace with the Palestinians at its center. So it goes against all of his conceptions and his paradigms. And it's forcing him to do the one thing that he hates more than anything, maybe outside of going to prison, which is admitting he was wrong.
Yeah, that's the most important thing for him. But I want to be minded of our time. We have a lot more to talk about. So we'll figure out, you know, it's your second appearance in my podcast. We should start making it a regular basis. But I want to end with something, you know, I would say optimistic.
Please.
So, and honestly, I don't know what kind of an optimistic question to ask you. So I want you to come up with something bright that you see in the upcoming future when we're talking, you know, opportunity-wise.
I think I have one. I think one of the things that the political center-left in Israel, or just the left, you take it where you want, has been very shy about is talking politics.
Right.
The right wing has no problem doing that. If we do it, then they say, oh my God, how dare you speak of politics? But they're doing it all the time.
See, them and Greta.
And you mentioned the budget issues, which is purely due to right-wing politics shenanigans. I think there might be a chance at this current moment. It's an inflection point, as Biden called it, but not only in the outside world and in how Israel carries itself in the world, but also internally. It's a moment where so many people on the liberal camp are saying no more of this shit. No more will someone call the kibbutzniks privileged when they, you know, suffer so many casualties. No more will people call the former IDF generals who are expressing left-wing opinions
anarchists
or traitors. That's gone. That's out the window. And I think this is a moment where a side of Israeli politics, which has been quite dormant for years, and even during the judicial overhaul and the protests, was apprehensive about bringing the conflict into it, right? It was always like, let's not talk about the conflict because we've got support. Let's not ruin it. Now, all of a sudden, we've got massive support in the polling. I don't remember in my lifetime such a swing in the polls from the current government to what is the polls. But I think there is actually a moment where our ideas and our thought, not just that, you know, we're not Netanyahu, but also that we are who we are, that is having a moment in the spotlight. And if we use that correctly, there is actually a chance, not a huge one, but a chance, to bring Israel back to what its forefathers had in mind, which I think, I dare say, and this is a big saying, but I dare say it's closer to what you and I have in mind than what Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir and Smotrich have in mind. And I think that's a big win, if we can do it. It's a big win.
Let's hope so. And we'll see what's going to happen the day after the war.
Whenever that may be.
Yeah, let's hope it's going to be fast and that our hostages are going to be back home, hopefully alive and well. We owe it to the families, I will say. I think that's the least we can do for the families of the hostages.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you very much for being with me today.
Thank you. Lovely to have you in our offices.
Hey, my pleasure. As I said, I'm willing to relocate.
We can discuss the rent later.
Definitely. Thank you, Ido.
Thank you.